This is an interview with Mr. Harry Alley. It's taking place in his office in the Indigenous Coordination Council, is it, Centre, in Elizabeth Street in Surry Hills. The date is, I think, the 7th of November 2008. My name's Margot Beasley. The project is Aboriginal Servicemen and Women, Oral History Project, being done on behalf of the City of Sydney's History Program. Okay, Harry, so I met you, I think, originally through a project which is separate to this one but linked, called the Coloured Digger Project, which is, I guess it's a large project with, I suppose you would say, it is basically about getting recognition for Indigenous servicemen and women, many of whom were, particularly after the major world wars, were treated pretty badly, and their contribution has not really been recognised. Is that the correct way to describe the Coloured Digger Project?
That would be correct, Margot. The more so from a Sydney and certainly a Redfern, the Indigenous community in Redfern have always had that belief that they would like to sort of honour and highlight the recognition of those servicemen and women and who served their country, and the community was saying down there they wanted something unique to them. There's been other things that have done throughout Australia, but nobody seems to hear much about those things, and it's always been a community thing. But this time Redfern felt they wanted to do something in their community. Because of the interaction that Pastor Ray Minicon has with the community, we came forward and to sort of give him the support. What has progressively happened over the last couple of years is through word has got through that where people can come down and support the event and also have a bit of closure themselves, particularly those families that lost their loved ones in overseas conflict. So it's a little bit for them to sort of give the show to us, and so to get their brothers or their sisters or their grandfathers or their uncles or whatever that recognition on that they did serve their country.
When you say us, do you mean the people who are involved with the committee that runs the Coloured Digger Project?
It's a little bit of everything. Like when you're sort of from a community organisation, there are so many aspects in your community. You have naturally your veterans and your ex-service people who have served their country and sort of come along and sort of march with the community. A lot of the early days is, and we all, particularly service people, have always said that the reason why we sort of went on as long as what we did and endured is because we had that love and support of the community, wherever that community was, whether it was here in Sydney or whether it was in the Torres Strait or even in Darwin or whatever. And that's a little bit, it's a two-way thing where recognition from the service fraternity gives it back to our community, and to sort of proudly sort of say, well, this is my mother and my auntie or whatever, and we sort of have a great delight in doing that as well as they themselves say, well, that's my uncle, he served his country, and things like that. So it's a togetherness type thing, and probably as the time goes by with the ageing veteran community where they are, then that legacy will be up to our children and grandchildren to carry on that tradition and to give recognition for the for those people that went away and served their country. I think probably that tide is changing right across, not only Indigenous, but certainly the non-Indigenous side, and particularly with migration, where it's becoming a bigger issue in Australia, where these traditions were forged and where they served their country. I think even today, as you look at the modern Defence Force, there's many faces there now that characterises that we are a multicultural Australia. So, but we have also, like from the Aboriginal and Torres Strait concept, we've encouraged and tried to be role models to the younger ones coming up, where they can say, well, we've served our country, we went through these problems of coming away from home. There were issues like of homesickness, of moving away from your close to loved ones and your family. But again, it's the support that you get from home that keeps you going and things like that. The communication levels today are much better because of the internet, the phone. In our day, we'd had to depend on letters. That sort of thing was too dear or too expensive to try and sort of ring home or whatever, and you're always conscious of the beeps on the phone. That sort of, if the 3 minutes were up, and if you didn't have any more money to put in the payphone, then you'd sort of say, well, it's got to get cut off now, I love you, let's keep writing, and hopefully we'll see you soon, and clonk, it'd go off. So these sort of things are always conscious in our minds, and particularly of being homesick, and before you sort of have formed a relationship and had a family of your own, you tended to do that, and you'd be allowed to go home once every 12 months, which the service paid for you. So, but you'd be home for that. You'd extend all your leave as long as you could to be at home, and you'd always dread getting on the train to come back to your unit. And many a time there'd be people crying at the station, and that sort of wait till the hand was completely out of sight, and then you'd throw a hanky or a shirt out just to get that little bit more distance of I love you as I'm going, I just can't wait till I sort of come back home. So those things you remember very uniquely.
And so that's how it was for you.
Very much so, yeah.
So you, when did you join the forces?
I joined in 1966. I felt that I wanted to serve my country. I missed two national service intakes. I missed out on the first one, then I was just out of the bracket for the second one.
So you'd have been happy for national service?
Yes, I would have been. But by doing the option, I felt that I wanted to join the Air Force as opposed to the Army. So I was a little bit fortunate. I was a qualified linesman under the Postmaster General's Department, but I wanted to go into the Air Force as a linesman, but they had no vacancies.
Can you just tell me what a linesman does?
Well, a PMG linesman, which in the old days, if you went away, it was a 2-year lineman course, and which we had to go to Brisbane, so that was I had to get leave Charters Towers to go to Brisbane.
So yes, because of course you were from far north Queensland.
Yes, yeah. And up there, and a lot of the things were capital city based, the major things like that. And so I had my 2 years, but in those days, to get what they call a city posting or job, you had to do what they call 3 years Western service. So I ended up going into a line party, which was out around between a place called Ewan, which is about halfway between Mount Isa and Townsville, and we were camped in tents. But because that 3-year thing, they wouldn't let you come into a town, into a normal job, into the bigger town.
So what was it like out there?
Well, at that stage, the government was putting two sets of wires, for the Defence Force because of the what they termed the communist move out of Asia. So we were sort of running these extra wires, and plus they were also upgrading the Townsville to Mount Isa railway line. So they had three major contractors for the upgrading of the railway line. The idea to upgrade the railway line was so that they were going to have their first mile and a half trains with silver lead coming out of Mount Isa. So they tried to take all the hills and straighten the railway line. So they had three main three main contractors, which was Hornibrook, who did all the track laying, Theus Brothers, who did all the approaches for the new bridges, and Hornstroth, who did all the bridges, and they diverted the main railway line off over these new high-level bridges. And then the PMG, because the telegraph line always run alongside the railway line, the PMG's role was to shift the telegraph line out so they didn't interfere with the deviation of the railway line.
Mm-hmm.
But which meant that, because that was the first time of mass employment in North Queensland, so there was a lot of Torres Strait men come out working on these jobs, and there'd been nothing for at least 1,000 men to end up in a small town of 300 mm-hmm. on weekends, and plus the PMG, but we were in much smaller numbers in compared to the main contractors that were doing for the railway line. But you had to grow up the hard way, because it was very male-dominated towns and things, and it was sort of certainly...
How old were you when you first went out there?
I would have been 62 years. I would have been about 20 years when I went out. About 20.
Still
when
pretty
I went
young.
There, yeah.
Mm.
And but when you're young, you think you're gung ho and bulletproof, and nobody's sort of gonna take you down. But it's a very. It makes you sort of aware of growing up with men. Some men are very hard to understand. There was a major drinking that went on. It was a culture. It was a very hot thing. The social aspect, men drank in very big ways.
I think we probably should stress that you're not talking about Indigenous men, you're talking about all men out there.
All men, yeah. The larger, the major population, the workforce, was Aboriginal and mainly Torres Strait as opposed to Aboriginal. But because they were working long days, they were working 12-hour days and six-day weeks, the idea of the seventh day was a maintenance day and washing day, and that's also the day we played football. So it was a sort of a pretty male-dominated culture out there, and certainly women that sort of came out into that sort of certainly, I believe, sort of had a tough like putting up with that sort of thing. But then that's how it goes, I guess.
And I think you told me once before that you were out there one day and it was extremely hot. And you thought it was very, very hot, and you were very tired, and you've been working really hard, and you thought there's got to be a better way to make a living than this. Is that right?
Am
I remembering correctly?
You are, yes. Like when you're young, just to quote you an example, how people in the other part of the world sort of think. What we used to do, when the same as all the railway workers, they used to have the main train going from town to the matter, but we'd all sing out paper, but what the idea was, the local paper that they'd bought in town, they'd write a red, the idea was to throw it out so we could get the paper or the magazine, because we didn't have access, except some of the naive. I was on a train one day, one of the naive ladies she said, oh, those poor men, they want paper. So she ran into the toilet and pulled all the toilet paper and threw out the window. And of course, the idea was we never had much, there was no television, and the main thing was radio. And I sort of my mother's words always stuck in the back of my mind to keep improving myself, and there are better things. So, and a friend of mine who I was working with, his brother had just joined the Air Force, and he was saying how he was enjoying life in Melbourne because he was posted at Laverton or somewhere. And so I thought about it, and it was a stinking hot day there. It was about 44 degrees or something, and we used to have these whirlies that just sort of big wind things that pick up all the spin effects or whatever there was, and just
dust
and you're fighting your way through the dust. And I said, oh, you'd come home, and then the blokes, it'd be payday, and the blokes would, because being at that age, we weren't into drinking, we'd go up to with them to start with, and then they'd come home late when the pubs are closed, and
we'd just drunk, sort of, were they?
Yeah. And okay, well, they left us alone, but oh, even if they did, they'd come and wake us up and say, come down and have a thing. But you can only put up, and we'd been doing it for 3 years, and well, I had been, and probably coming back into a city, there was a number of things that sort of, because I'd kept in contact with a couple of friends in Brisbane and things like that, so I felt, I'll see if I can join the Air Force. There must be something. Not understanding that. I'd been in the school cadets and had a bit of an understanding of military. But the other thing is, I come from a very disciplined family. All my mother and father and all, both of the uncles and aunties on both sides always kept an eye on us. And if we didn't do the right thing, we were kicked up the backside, or we got back to my mother and my father, and sometimes that was better than the toweling down that you got from your parents, I guess. I was, from discipline was never a problem, so.
And self-discipline, you mean?
Self-discipline, mm. Yeah.
And so you thought that you'd be okay in the armed services for that?
I always felt that. And I had no problem with, like, school cadets is nothing compared to the real thing in discipline, but I felt that I could make it. So as a result of that, then I did join the Air Force, and but in saying that, then having to get up and after swearing your allegiance to the Queen, and you're on a plane, and next minute you're in Adelaide and doing 10 weeks recruit course, and not allowed into town for the first 8 weeks of it, and so that didn't. I settled into it, the discipline, but probably the hardest thing then is when I had to do my trade training in Wagga. Then my first posting was to East Sale, which is in Gippsland, South Gippsland. And it's a very, everybody goes to bed with a foul because it's that cold. And
it was a very quiet life, was it?
It was something until you get to know people. And I always, a friend of mine said to me, he said, when in one of my things when I was trying to settle, he said, 3 months is always the worst in any job that you go to. He said, till you get to know the running order and who's who, and they get to know you, you're going to bounce. And I took that on, but I must admit, I looked at an assessment of the calendar of the 3 months, and I say that to so many of the young people today, when particularly the young Indigenous ones that come to Sydney or even in the bigger cities after being out there, I said, don't try and change the world in the first month, because you're not going to do that. And I always pass that word of advice on to the young people today, and it's true to life in a lot of things that you do. It still happens to me even today. I still use that philosophy.
That it just takes time to get used to something.
Yeah, mm. And then you know where you're going. And
mm.
And then you can sort of start changing the world a bit if you want.
So when you did, what was your trade training in the Air Force then?
I went into it completely. It was logistics. So in those days, we adopted the RAF, a lot of the culture and the terminologies. And it wasn't until we sort of withdrew out of Vietnam that they changed a lot of the to the American terminologies, defence with an S, and and logistics and all that. So they were in the RAF thing. It was either equipment or supply, and was always being sort of changed around, and they were changing the command structures. And so, but certainly I noticed dealing with the guys that had come out of Vietnam, and for also for my own dealings when I went to the America for the ferry of the F-111s, where I was dealing with the Americans in their own setup.
For the what of the F-111s? Ferrying, did you say?
When I finally got posted out of sail after 5.5 years.
5.5 years in sail. Well, you must have got used to the cold.
I met my wife and had my sons born there. So.
Oh, that's nice.
But I got a posting to Amberley, and I'd down in the, what they call the maintenance squadron, 482 maintenance squadron. And I arrived there as they were leasing the F-4 Phantoms, which until the government made up their mind on whether they were going to accept delivery of the F-111s, which they'd bought 10 years or quite a number of years previously. And so I sort of had a lot to do with the lease of the sort of resupply and all that sort of thing. And then when they were ready to send back the Phantoms after the lease, arranging some of that equipment to go back to the various Air Force bases in America. So then my equipment officer, when they were looking for a guy of my mustering, selected me to go over, because they had the idea for the government is they had to have 6 F-111s fly over Amberley. I forget the exact date, the 2nd of June 1973 or whatever, at exactly 11:30 a.m. they would step off the aircraft, the minister would meet them, and it was set to a tight schedule. But the idea is they had to have, they had 8 aircraft on, they had 2 spare just in case they lost one for the long ferry. And because the F-111s had never been flown over such a vast amount of water, I went over as the logistics guy, and then they sent a team down to Edwards Air Force Base in California. Oh, this was in California, but Southern California. And they did trials to see how they could, what the best performance they'd get out of engines and all that sort of thing. Then after they did their trials, a lot of the data was sort of analysed and then to get the best maximum performance out of the aircraft. And then I stayed there till the second. What they did is they'd bring them out of the factory, Fort Worth General Dynamics, at six at a time, or in that second case, because they brought a couple up on standby, they brought a wrap so that there was another 6 ready to go for the next ferry. And then I did my stint, and then I come back, and then but it was very enriched period of my life, because when I was there, when we were flying over, we went over by Hercules aircraft out of Amberley too. We flew into Pango Pango, spent a night, then we flew into Hickam Air Force Base, and then we flew into McClellan Air Force Base. But when we were at Hickam, this first lot of POWs were stayed, they were coming out of Vietnam. They brought them out of Vietnam into Clark Air Force Base.
American POWs.
Mm. And it's one of the most moving things that I'd ever seen in my life.
Tell me about that. Yeah.
They marched them off under ceremonial flags into the terminal just as the sun was rising, and it just, everybody had a complete lump in their throat. But then when we were in America, and probably the tie the yellow ribbon around the old oak tree was the theme thing, and a lot of that was happening in America, and that was my favourite tune that I sort of, my wife and I, because we were related to the absence that we were away from my children and her. And even now when they play it, it still brings back that period. And again, we got back to the old letter writing, and sometimes the letters got delayed or something, and But I wrote every day while I was away. And
How long were you away?
I was away for about 5 to 6 months at that stage.
Mm.
But there was other things when we got back to Australia in the squadron where they had to do flight trials, so we were moving in and out of Darwin while they did their sort of operational sort of exercises. And so in that 3 year period that I was there at Ambley, I was away quite a bit of it. So, but that's how your wife and your children cope.
And I guess it's the same for everybody in the Defence Forces, that kind of separation thing. But I wonder if it's true that it's a different experience again for Indigenous people. I don't necessarily mean you particularly, but whether the separation from home might be more extreme, particularly for the young ones, because they might feel a bit culturally out of place.
It's always aware of it, like even if that's what I always know, then it would be the same for them. Although within your own sort of in work environment, it's mateship, you get on well, but it's the other areas of social atmosphere that you go to that you're made aware of. I, for example, when I went from North Queensland down to Adelaide, I've run into a couple of instances where they wouldn't serve me. But what I did, because of the mateship, I used to always wait to the last one to shout, so that when I went up, they said, "Oh, we can't serve you," or the blokes would walk, but at least they had a beer and things like that. And it's funny how things stick in your mind because of that. North Queensland is still in areas and spots there, there's still that sort of thing that goes on. Some of the Australians today are much more, understand the story a bit more, like they've heard the stories and the things like that, so they're more understanding, whereas in that day and age that nobody was aware of that, and you were seen as a group sort of thing, and like there's good and bad and everything.
But there was, Aborigines, I guess, were like in a way stereotyped, or for most Australians, they were kind of two-dimensional because most white Australians wouldn't even know an Aboriginal person.
No, that's right.
And so their images and their perceptions were all coming from some strange place, like a history book or something like that. So you're up against that as well as, you know, innate racism, I guess, which is was very extreme then and, you know, still with us today.
That's right.
So, it's a whole big bag of things, isn't it?
Well, that's why the RSL, and despite everything, there were some good ones, but there were some bad ones. They went in there, they were alienated. Charters Towers was a little bit better than in towns, mainly because of the community that we had up there, but there were instances where mates brought beers out to them and all that sort of thing, but even the blokes in my community, they never spent much time in there as a pub. Well, that's probably...
Never spent much time in the pub, you mean?
And in the club on the day.
On Anzac Day, And because they never really felt... 100% part of it.
Yeah, they never felt comfortable.
Mm.
And it only takes one to make a comment, and that can upset the whole scene for the day. And despite you think you can get over it or you're above that, it's still sort of in the back of your mind. And things are changing in the modern thing, where people will automatically come to your defence and sort of... in today, and I've noticed that on some things that have been said in my case, but whereas that wouldn't have happened in that early day.
So what sort of things are you thinking of when you say that people come to your defence?
Well, for example, somebody might say who doesn't understand, what are you doing here? And not...
Where? In the RSL?
In the RSL, for example. like irrespective of the day and the meaning of it.
Yeah.
But not thinking, they would sort of say something like that, and if you're wary about sort of treading in there or working in there, and what you tend to do is move to the back and so you don't make yourself a prominent type sort of situation.
So in other words, you don't have that kind of innate sense that most Australian service people, particularly mostly men, I guess, would have of just being a fully equal part of all of that.
Yeah.
Anzac Day and all of that. Like, yeah. if you're putting yourself at the back,
yeah.
that means
yeah.
I'm at the back. I'm not part of this, really.
Yeah.
I'm trying to share it, but
yeah.
I can't.
Well, a lot of the community used to say, well, when a couple of the blokes used to march, they used to go down the back of the flight anyway. And, of course, a lot of the exasperation used to sort of, from the community, why are all the black fellas down the back again, and why can't you march up the front? But there's a little bit of not understanding either that the RSL protocol is always the eldest veterans, whether it be World War One and they come through, and the last conflict, the return have precedent over X, and that's the way that. The unspoken protocol is.
Right, so sometimes you might be down the back
yeah.
for reasons that haven't got anything to do with
yeah.
skin colour.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Like if you haven't seen active service, for instance?
Yeah, that's right, and that's what was in the old days. I don't know whether it's as much today. I've never sort of gone down there, and I haven't watched... I haven't been in a big parade to see. Probably you don't notice it much here because they form up in their battalions or their units on what they serve. But in a sort of a bigger thing where they're all together, particularly the sub-branch members or the RSLs, all are returned and all marched together. But because of it's not as much today, they all sort of line up and just sort of the way you sort of line up. But in the old days...
It was very formalised.
That was formalised, yeah.
Mm.
And when you were serving, there was an unsung thing that you paid respect to those returned guys. We were asked to sort of do catafalque parties or participate. Then it was expected of you to acknowledge those guys. I can't speak for what the protocols are or what's expected of them today, but I think there'd be still something that would be handed down. It's another thing that would be sort of handed down and expected, I guess.
Mm. So when you joined the Air Force, you said that you actually wanted to serve your country.
Yeah.
And can you tell me a bit more about that? Like, during those times, I mean, this must have been during the Vietnam War.
Yes, it was all geared up, yeah.
So, very different circumstances to today. So what was it that made you feel as though you wanted to serve your country?
Well, because my two uncles and my auntie, one uncle was in World War One, and he served in World War Two. I had another uncle that served in World War Two. My auntie was served in the Land Army.
How did she?
And I can always remember growing up, but my grandmother lived next door. That was always the photo on the mantelpiece with them in uniform. And it never sort of, the fact, and plus my grandfather, he looked after the stockyard for the horses to go over to Egypt. And
in World War One.
World War One.
He was in Charters Towers?
Yes, yeah. And they used to bring the horses in from the station. Then they'd hold them in the paddock at Blackjack, on my father's side, my grandmother and grandmother. And then they'd ship them out from there. So we've sort of had a bearing on, sort of been, have an understanding of that sort of involvement and commitment. In saying that, when I went down one door and joined the Air Force, my brother felt that he wanted to join the services, and he's younger than me, but because the Air Force didn't want him, he went in the other door, so he joined the Army. But he ended up in Vietnam, so...
did he?
But because the Air Force only had aircraft, because of the minimal sort of involvement, I didn't go to Vietnam.
Minimal involvement of the Air Force,
But
did you want to go to Vietnam?
Oh, yeah, I volunteered. I did hear that I was on standby to go, because they said what you had to do in those days, depending on what squadron you were going to. If you were going to Iroquois helicopters, then you were expected to go into Fairburn to do an M60 machine gun course before you went, plus any other training that you required while you were over there. But at that time, there was they were brought back. I think it was the Labor government brought them back, Gough Whitlam.
1972, they brought everybody back from Vietnam, so...
Yeah.
You didn't have your chance to...
No.
To go.
No.
But did you, in general, you supported that war? You thought it was a just war?
Well, because we were sort of, we had to respond on, which was expected to you of a serviceman, there were certain aspects that you thought about. Certainly, there was other things like the domino effect and it was better to fight them up there. That was one of the things that...
That was one of the big theories at the time, wasn't it?
That was one of the things that were going on. I was also around in that time when they came back and the paint was poured over them when they did the march down Melbourne. And
red paint was thrown over some of the return servicemen.
When they were marching, they did a march in Melbourne, so some of the anti-Vietnam thing poured red paint over one of the guys. Plus, it was very strong towards the end to get them home, the anti-Vietnam demonstration. In the end, if you weren't allowed to wear uniform in Melbourne, in the city of Melbourne, you had to wear civilian clothes, and that wasn't taken off for quite a number of years later. So.
As that was as a protective thing. Yeah. So.
But I can remember going to Melbourne, quiet thing, and you were a bit ostracised as well because of the short haircut, which short haircuts wasn't the go in those days.
No, you could pick an army or police person, couldn't you, because of the hairdo.
And I sort of seen things where we were at a party and there was sort of one girl come up and said, oh, baby killers and things, but yeah, you just sort of had to rise above and you didn't provoke anything, you sort of, so you tended to keep that to yourself, but again you supported the guys that went, and when they come home you made sure that they picked up where they come back.
Did your brother come home okay?
My brother came home okay, yeah, he like a lot of those Vietnam vets, some of the stuff is coming out with them in later life. So again, we support them. We've always supported them. My sister, when David was in Vietnam, she used to, when they cut across the news, she used to break down. She used to get very emotional.
Worrying about him.
We still worried about him. He wanted to come back to Sydney for R&R, so I made sure I come in and spent the time with him while he was with R&R.
Oh, that's good.
And all those sort of things. So, and plus, we used to make sure the wives were looked after, the lawns were mowed and all those sort of things.
When you say we, who do you mean there?
The guys at the unit.
Right.
If the wives sort of had anything that in any form or shape that she felt that she couldn't talk to the padre or anybody, then... If it just in discussion, if she was talking to one of the wives, then she might say something to our wives, and then the wives would say to us that such and such is not travelling too well. Or so it was that commandery to sort of look after each other. And
so that was actually like a military thing or an Air Force thing.
Yeah.
Not
They would all do the same.
That was part of being part of that unit, that you'd take care of each other a bit. And